We have come to the third talk in Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 17 to 32. Dick is about to look back what we have learned in the last two talks, verses 1 to 16. He begins by saying, I cannot have a growing relationship with Christ without having a relationship with my fellow Christians. And his first point is, in recuperating, is I cannot have a growing relationship with Christ without having a relationship with my fellow Christians. Dick.
I cannot have a growing relationship with Christ without having a relationship to my fellow Christians. I know that sounds obvious, but he's worked this out. To him, it's tremendously important. I mean, I was a curate at a real old-fashioned parish church. In a typical Church of England parish church in a country town, Sevenoaks. At 8 o'clock communion in the morning, the well-to-do came into communion and they walked straight in with their heads to the front and straight out again with their heads to the front. And you didn't see them at church the rest of the day. Probably on the golf hill. See, that was their idea of Christianity, and no one disabused them. You didn't look to left or right. You didn't want to talk with anybody at the door. A limp handshake with the rector, that was enough. Now you see, once you put your mind into Paul's thinking, that's unthinkable. I mean, take modern evangelism as another illustration. Because we don't want to tread on one another's toes with regard to baptism, the modern evangelist is virtually forced to call upon people to make a decision about their relationship to Christ, quite apart from the church. Well, of course, there's a lot of kerfuffle afterwards, but we must follow them up, so we must put them in touch with the local church. But you see, when I come to the New Testament, I cannot make a decision in Acts 2 without being baptized. Of course, if you're baptized, you're plunged not so much into the water, but you're plunged into church life straight away, aren't you? A very interesting insight, isn't it? You cannot become a Christian in the New Testament without meeting your fellow Christians. It's impossible. In the modern evangelistic campaign, it might easily get muddled up in the campaign office, you see, where the envelopes are filled in. But long before that moment had arrived in the New Testament, evangelism meant that you were linked to the local church. See, now, about a mission to London, there's a church I heard of where they had 50 names and they're not in touch with any of them today. Now, of course, they may have gone off to a better church. Let's hope it was there, for their sakes. That is unthinkable to the apostle. Absolutely unthinkable. He would simply say that there was no conversion of any kind at the beginning because they were not plunged into a living community. You can work this out in all sorts of ways. It means, you see, that the boy or girl who's been brought up in a crusader class or a Christian union that is full of fellowship and then dumped at home in a church where there is no fellowship is absolutely at sea because it doesn't recognize this as church. Church to them meant a warm group. That's the first thing. And secondly, as I'm just trying to show you how to meditate in the study period. You ask yourself, he's been talking a lot about the Christian church in these first 16 verses. What constitutes the Christian church? In other words, what makes it church? Well, the Roman Catholic and Anglo-Catholic view is that apostolic succession makes it church. Now, if that's the way you think, you see, you face quite different problems than another person does. We've just had staying at St. Helens two young bishops of the Church of England in South Africa, which is a great problem to the Church of Providence in South Africa. There are two Church of England in South Africa. But the real problem is that both those bishops have been validly consecrated in the apostolic succession. Therefore, you can't write their church off. That's one of the problems, is it? But of course, that's a meaningless statement once you've understood Paul. Doesn't matter what succession anybody is consecrated in. The issue is their church based on apostolic truth? Therefore, you see, when they're dealing with these great church issues today, what they're all concerned about in the Anglican church is, can we come back to Rome? Which is a totally irrelevant question to the apostle. The apostle's question is, can we come back to the truth? You're moving in quite different worlds when you ask those two questions. But you cannot find out how to think properly unless you soak yourself in the way the apostles thought. It is quite clear, isn't it, all the way yesterday, that what matters is that we speak the truth, that we teach the truth, that the truth is taught to us, and so on. Then, I wonder if you've noticed already the problems of establishing churches in paganism. You see, for the last 400 years, the last 200 years, let us say, last 100 years, we've been establishing Christian groups in a Christian culture, or at least a quasi-Christian culture. What we are facing now, it won't be my problem, but it'll be the next generation's problem, is that they've got to establish churches in these vast states, which are really pagan cultures. Right, now we come back to Paul with a new understanding. How did he face that? See, well, he is writing to people who are only an inch away from paganism. And he expects them to understand a letter like the Epistle to the Ephesians. Is that not striking? Does that not blow your mind? Here are we wrestling with the Epistle to the Ephesians and imagining that it's difficult and that Stott must write 800 pages to explain it to us. And this was written to a congregation of young Christians just out of paganism. Shame on us. We can't understand it. Where are we? But because we breathe slightly different air in a civilization that's impregnated with Christian truth, we don't realize how startling this is. He takes them all the way from paganism to this. Immediately. Then the last thing I want to say is I've just meditated on this overnight and this morning, you see, is I wonder if you've got a picture, as you've read, of the greatness of Paul's Christ. I think it's very important to get this clear in the whole biblical revelation. Now there is the world drawn by my circle, and there is Israel. This is the Old Testament picture. And all the religions of the world in the ancient world, of course, as they still are in paganism and idolatry, imagine that they have a little enclave and they have their own god. It may be Marduk, or it may be, what are the names of some of these other gods? I've forgotten. All these gods that they had. And so they regarded the Israelites as having their god, who was Jehovah. And Jehovah is interested in this little tiny circle here. That's his patch, you see. Mustn't interfere with anybody else's patch. But of course, that isn't how the Old Testament was written at all, is it? Alone amongst all the great religious books of the ancient world, the Old Testament says that the God of this patch is the one who made all that. Now, if you think like that, you see, it's going to make a very great deal of difference to the way you think. Israel never came to terms with that. But it was latent, it was lying there hidden, so to speak, within their own faith that their God must want the whole world. And of course in Christ claimed it. Now precisely the same illustration, you see. There's a great danger when I become a Christian of thinking, let's just turn this map, I'm just redoing the map now, forget all that. Here's the Christian church, you see. So when you're converted, people think, well, their interest is religion, that's their patch. His interest is golf. And her interest is the home. And so on. But your interest is that, you see. But the Christ of the New Testament will not allow me to suppose that he is interested in me alone and in the church alone, as though Christ's patch is just the church. His patch is the whole world, isn't it? Right. Now, with that in mind, you see, once more back, because Colossians, in a sense, puts it in shorthand, and Ephesians takes longer to say it. Look back to Colossians 1, verse 15. Now, he's going to say in verse 18 that Christ is the head of the body of the church, which is what Ephesians is wrestling with, isn't it? It's what we're going on with this morning. But before he can say that he's the head of the body of the church, he must say, verse 15 onwards, that he is the head of all creation, because he made it all. You see? I mean, we won't read it all because there isn't time now. It is very important to realize that. The Christ we are looking at is not a Christ who is concerned with religion only. He is concerned with the whole world. It all belongs to him. That's why, in the end, it's impossible, isn't it, to keep Christianity out of politics or sport or education or anything else, in the end, because the whole world belongs to Christ. So we can't see what the world wants to say to us. All right, then, you have your Sunday. It's what you Christians like, apparently, as one day in seven. But we have to say, but the Christ who made the world made that as a worldwide ordinance. All men need it. Well, I won't follow that up, but it's the kind of meditation that you would look at as you go back over the material we've done. This Christ, then, is a great Christ. And we saw that in verse 4, 5, 6. We've seen that throughout verses 1 to 16. Now let's go on to verse 17 onwards. What is the third appeal? He's now rattling his tin again. He's got another appeal on his hands. I want to share with you his third concern. And his third concern comes straight out of the other two, and it is quite simply that we should live differently from our pagan background, the Gentile world. That's his third concern. And that one is going to take us right through today and right through Wednesday and most of Thursday as well, because a great deal of the rest of the letter is taken up with this. Now, this I affirm and testify in the Lord, that you must no longer live as the Gentiles do. That's the appeal. And that appeal, of course, comes right out of the Sermon on the Mount. Do you remember how often the Lord says in the Sermon on the Mount, but of course the Gentiles do that, don't they? Say, you can't do it. The Gentiles worry. I expect there are members of your family who do that, aunts and grandparents and others. Worry. And Jesus said, but you can't do that. That's how the Gentiles live. So this comes right out of our Lord's teaching, his soil, the soil of his teaching. And so I take it that this is absolutely axiomatic to apostolic Christianity, that we no longer live as the Gentiles do. What is so striking about this, and this again is quite astonishing, really, is that he is talking to a congregation, or rather congregations, because Ephesians is a round-robin letter. And these congregations consist of Gentiles, that is, pagans, and Jewish converts. Now, when you've said that, you realize what a tough thing he's saying. He's saying to Jewish converts, you mustn't live as the Gentiles do. They'd have been horrified at that. Because the Jewish standards are much higher, of course, than the pagan, especially in terms of sexual purity, which is going to come up very strongly in chapter 5. Yet, you see, Paul assumes that Judaism, now that it has lost its Messiah, will begin to be assimilated into the pagan world. In other words, Paul has no confidence that without the living power of God, whatever our background and traditions we've been brought up with, we shall be re-assimilated into paganism fairly quickly. And that's certainly happening today, isn't it? It doesn't matter how well brought up children are today, they will be assimilated into the culture of the teenager, the student, the whatever it is. They will be assimilated without the power of God. And those pressures are very, very strong, aren't they? Not just in an area like Bethnal Green, but in every area, even in the most posh areas. Surrey and the Stockbroker Belt is not able to avoid this for its children. Right, well, let's look then at this pagan world. Let's look at the reality of paganism as the apostles saw it. And what they saw as at the root of paganism was a darkness of mind. I can't tell you how important this is, but it'll come out in the next day or two how important this is in the whole way in which Ephesians talks of the Christian life. That, to the Apostle Paul, was the root of why paganism is how paganism is. You must not live as the Gentiles do in the futility of their minds. They are darkened in their understanding. They are alienated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them. I don't know if you love the hunting of the snark and things like that. It just tickles my funny bone, Lewis Carroll's type of humour. You know, what the bellman says when he rings his bell energetic, what I tell you three times is true. Well, I always feel that when I'm reading the Apostle. If he's ever got anything on his mind that's important, he always says it three times. It's a primary school. Look at it, three times. Futile minds, darkened in understanding, alienated from the life of God. By the way, futility is the word vanity, which is a word associated in the ancient world with idols. To Paul, to be involved in idolatry was to be involved in vanity and futility. In other words, once I leave God behind, life becomes futile and I can't see any meaning in it. Hence the great concern people have at the moment of the rising number of suicides amongst young people in our country. It's always been so, of course, in pagan countries. A country like Japan has always had a very high rate of suicide, but it's now becoming something that's encroaching on our own society, isn't it? I was reading an article about it only this very last week of the number of youngsters contemplating suicide because life is futile and meaningless. Now, that is all the more striking to us, you see. When I was at college, you know, the liberal professors simply couldn't accept this kind of talk of Paul because they said, well, we live since the Enlightenment. I mean, we are post-Enlightenment people. How do you spell Enlightenment? I can never spell on these things. And we are post-Enlightenment people, and therefore we think that we no longer have the intellectual framework of these ancient people. So we are post-Enlightenment people. For 200 years we have regarded ourselves in Europe as people who are enlightened, which meant rationalistic, which meant actually unbelieving. Now, that's a very, very serious thing, isn't it, you see? Europe is different from America here, please take note. America was not cursed with the Enlightenment in the same way. Theism, the whole idea of God, is still very prevalent in America, but not in Europe. And therefore, this very much has something to say to modern Europe, and we're part of Europe, whether we like it or not. So, the typical Christian thinker of the 20th century that you were presented with as a student or in the sixth form, the Sartre, the Camus, these people are unbelievers characteristically. Every one of them. Every one of them. Paul says that this is at the root of all our problems. Some of the, one of the funnies I say to the students, it isn't funny, my jokes aren't funny, so you're used to that. But, see, that's the Greek root from which you get agnostic and ignoramus. And I sometimes say to the students that at a party or a reception in the city, from time, and this does happen occasionally, someone will come up to me and they will say, with a complacent smile on their faces, well, seeing my dog collar, they say, well, you see, Mr. Lucas, I had a scientific training and I'm an agnostic. You know, almost as though I ought to say, how very interesting and how good of you. And yes, you are very sensible. And of course, we're all rather far behind. And I sometimes say to the students, nobody's ever come up to me at such a sort of party in the city and said to me, you know, Mr. Lucas, it's a very interesting thing, but I'm an ignoramus. Well, it's not very funny, really, is it? But, I mean, it's exactly the same root and exactly the same meaning. Slight difference, isn't there? But hardly any. And in terms of God, that is precisely what the modern man is, isn't he? He is an ignoramus. He is brilliant in every other way, no doubt, but he is an ignoramus. And this is due, says Paul, to hardness of heart, end of verse 18. There is the heart of the matter. It actually means literally a stubbornness. And if you think of some of your friends, some of them dear friends of yours, that you've tried to win for Christ and persuade to come to a Tuesday service or to read the Bible or to do anything that might bring them just a trace nearer Christian things, have you not met that stubbornness? Tough stubbornness? No. Paul puts his finger on that. He says, from that stubbornness comes the darkness of mind. And therefore, as a result of that, false thinking about God, and therefore false thinking about man, look what is the result. And now we come perilously close to our own day. Verse 19, will you follow the words, because they're so interesting. Because of this darkness, they have become callous. They've given themselves up to licentiousness. And they're greedy to practice every kind of uncleanness. Now, we won't wait on that, but those words have an ominous ring, don't they? Callous, that is the world, isn't it, of the terrorist. When we're so hard-hearted, we can Well, I mean, it still staggers me, that one of the man who made this girl pregnant and then put this plastic bomb in the bottom of her case and then put her on board the 400 LL jet to Israel. It's almost unbelievable, isn't it? For sheer... And then went back and sat in his hotel room. But can you believe it? For carelessness. Licentiousness, well, that's on every bookstall, isn't it? And covetousness means excessive self-assertion, a ruthless trampling on the rights of others, and we know something of that even within the precincts of the city, concerned only with the satisfaction of my impulses. And who of us is not touched with that? We feel somehow we have a right to satisfy our desires and appetites, and that's because of the world we live in. So there he paints in verse 19 something of the viciousness of pagan life. Now, I want you please to notice that that viciousness came ultimately from ignorance of God. That's, you see, you know where this is going to go, don't you? I can't hide from you where my treasure thing is going to go. If this kind of lifestyle comes from ignorance of God, then the only way back to the kind of lifestyle we want is through the knowledge of God. That's what Paul is saying. But he says you cannot shortcut it. In other words, here is the way society lives. Here is the way society thinks. Now, you cannot change how society lives without changing how society thinks. And I don't know if you've noticed the extraordinary way in which people talk today. I've forgotten what it was that was immediately blamed on the government. It was some form of permissiveness. As though the government has got any possibility of changing that. You can have all the best political figures in the country, and they cannot change society without society changing its thinking. And that's where we are, right there. That's where we are. That's what we're trying to do. Let me give you an example of that that we did with the wives, which has made a tremendous impression on me, needless to say, because I'm doing the speaking, I'm the one that learns the most. Turn back to Psalm 8. That's why I do urge you to teach somebody, even if it's only your husband when he comes back from work. That'll be a good welcome for him. That'll be a very cozy. Instead of the slippers, have a Bible reading ready for him. I don't mean for his benefit, but for yours. That was not part of my script, by the way. Forget it. I'll have Doug resigning. He gets back and Nancy's got a Bible study ready for him. I don't want that. Now, I don't want to go on a long lay-by, but this is so simple in a way and so fascinating. The framework of Psalm 8 you can see in the first verse and the last. What is the first and the last thing in Psalm 8? O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is thy name in all the earth. That is, it is a theistic framework. It says that God is God, and he is at the beginning, and he is at the end. It's theistic from start to finish. God, God, the God of the Bible. Now, that is your framework, to think. And so you ask a very great question in this psalm, as we studied together. It's in verse 4. Will you look at verse 4? There's the great question. It's one of the very greatest questions young people ask, or anybody asks. And in the end, all your children who we have with us here will be asking that question. It is, what is man? Or if you like to put it in slightly more with it language, who am I? What's life about? That's a terrific question, isn't it? Right. Now, we have no difficulty in that answer, and we'll come back to our answer in a moment, but let us imagine that your framework is now the framework of the 20th century post-Enlightenment, which is called by some people naturalism. That means that the universe is all that there is, matter is all that there is. This has captured all the universities, really, hasn't it, in the 20th century? And that the universe is a closed order, a mechanistic order, an impersonal order. It's beginning to crack a little now, thankfully. It's never been in America the absolute intellectual order. The church has always been stronger there, but in our society, we've sold out to evolutionism, naturalism, whatever you like to call it. Now, when you ask that central question now, with that framework, what answer do you get to what is man? in a closed natural scientific order, what answer do you get? You can only get one answer, that he is an animal, but a very superior one. So Darwin calls him the most dominant animal that the world has seen. Very flattering. See, Mike, you're the most dominant animal that the world has seen. That's why you're able to run your company. I hope you all feel flattered. Got it, Derek? That's what you are. That's not new. That's not new. We've been having this actually undergirding it for 90 years. Is it any surprise, therefore, that people behave rather like that? Because that's what they are. You cannot get any other answer to verse 4 if that is your framework. That means your mind is dark, if you believe that. The moment you go into that great cathedral in South Kensington, that magnificent Victorian masterpiece, I think it's a masterpiece, built like a cathedral, isn't it, the Natural History Museum? The moment you enter that, you surrender to naturalism. And as you know, there's a marvelous new exhibit on man. It's most beautifully done. It tells you everything about how you work, except how you work. I mean, you follow everything going round. You follow the blood. It's all right. I can't actually look at the whole exhibition without fainting. I mean, I've taken... If I take nephews and nieces, I have to sort of put my eye away from it like this. I mean, that's... I mean, David could do it, of course. He's used to it. But, you know, you've got everything there. Everything visible. The whole inside taken out, and you see how it works. But, of course, you can come out of that exhibition with no knowledge of who you are. It's telling you a great deal about yourself, but it doesn't answer. Now look at the answer in the Bible. It's one of the most wonderful answers, I think, that you could have. The answer is written into the question. What is man that thou art mindful of him? There's the answer. What is man but that your mind is upon him all the time? And the Son of Man that thou dost care for him? There's your answer, within the question. Man, according to that God framework, is one on whom God's mind and care is continually at work. Is that not a wonderful thought? I mean, if you believe that, you can really put aside all your cares as you leave this room this morning, can't you? That means that your family, you yourself, your children, that the Almighty God cares and has a mind for them as though there was nobody else. Now, there's no other answer like that, is there, in the whole of man's intellectual search. Nobody has discovered an answer like that. It comes from having the right framework. Back to Ephesians. Now that's what Paul is saying here. He's saying that these pagans, and they were very clever, the pagans. Don't forget that we're talking about a Greek civilization. In many ways, the Greeks are ahead of us still. They may not have had washing machines, but they had many, many wonderful things. And he says about that Greek civilization and that Roman civilization, that the reason it was callous and licentious and unclean and hard was because their understanding of God and man was wrong, full stop. Because when it came to God, they knew nothing. And therefore, because if you dismiss God, you dismiss humanity as well. Now look at verse 20. If you found all that rather heavy going, then surely we come out of a railway tunnel into the wonderful light of the summer in verse 20. You did not so learn Christ. I meant to make a family... You might like to make a family tree for yourself, incidentally. Here is man as a dominant animal, and you can work out his family. If he is ignorant of God... See, here is man without God, and so you say to yourself, let's think of man without God, and where has that been seen in the 20th century? Well, that was seen, of course, supremely in National Socialism, wasn't it? It is very interesting that theology first went down the plug hole in Germany in the 19th century. It was in Germany that errant rationalistic liberalism first invaded the churches and killed them. Two generations later, you get National Socialism and Nazism, where God has been forgotten, banished. So what are the children of man, the man of National Socialism? Well, you've got the Holocaust, haven't you? That's one of them. So you can make a long list. And what is the result of man now, a generation or two later? Well, you have abortion on demand. Something that our grandchildren, if there is a spiritual revival, and I'm optimistic to think that there will be, our grandchildren will look back and say, what were Granny and Grandpa doing that they didn't stand on every street corner and protest at this dreadful thing? Because that kind of thing, treating a living fetus, throwing it in the garbage can, as often happens, that kind of thing is the result, isn't it, of man who's lost his ability to think about God and therefore can't think straight about himself and therefore becomes callous. So you can make out the tree for yourself. Well, terrorism comes in here, doesn't it? Just throw a bomb at him. Now, notice what happens when we're converted. So we learn Christ. I've often pointed out that this is so unlike, isn't it, all the ways in which we tend to talk about Christianity. Shall we make a Lent discipline that we will give up, not just for Lent, but for the rest of the year, the phrase, commit yourself to Christ? It's a pretty inadequate phrase anyhow, isn't it? Because becoming a Christian is actually Christ committing himself to you, and that makes sense, doesn't it? Because frankly, if you commit yourself to Christ, you'll uncommit yourself pretty quickly when things go wrong. But if he commits himself to you, he won't uncommit himself when things go wrong. They learned Christ. Now, you'll see what that meant to the early Christians. When they converted, they learned Christ. At the beginning of Colossians 1 again, turn over two pages. Colossians 1:6, what do we read? The gospel has come to you as indeed in the whole world it is bearing fruit and growing. So among yourselves, from the day you heard and understood the grace of God in truth as you learned it from Epaphras, our beloved fellow servant. He's a faithful minister. It seems that Epaphras, I remember this from studying this for the commentary that I wrote very heavily on this, but at least my commentary was just about as heavy as Epaphras. He seems to have been a fellow without many gifts, without much colour, but just a faithful brother. You know, the kind of person who can say, well, he's very faithful. And I guess there'd been some criticism of Epaphras. But you see, look what Epaphras had done. They'd heard it from him, they'd understood it from him, and they had learned it. They're grand words, aren't they? That's how they'd been converted. Heard, understood, learned. Well, no wonder then that their lives were changed, because it had gone right in. Turn back to Matthew 13. Verse 19. Here then, the parable of the sower. Here's the fundamental basic parable of all parables. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes and snatches away what is sown in his heart. This is what was sown along the path. I find that a luminous comment, don't you? Satan cannot take away that which has been understood. If the seed is just popped there by the preacher, no one knows what he's talking about, but it sounds great, and it's there on the top of my head, Satan will plug it away right outside the church door. But if it is understood, he can't reach it. Even Christ's idea of evangelism was not anti-intellectual. The idea that you just got everybody worked up and then made them commit themselves to Christ and that would last is not known, is it, to the New Testament? It's got to be understood. Now, what's coming back to Ephesians, because time is going, don't worry, the wheels will be rattling soon. You never are far away from a cup of coffee in this place. And when you've got the right staff on duty, you're never far away from endless buns and cakes as well. Watch your waist. Sorry, that's not in Paul. Let's come back to Paul. Verse 20. You did not so learn Christ. Now, read John Stott for verse 21. He's superb on it, where he points out that the about is not in the Greek, assuming that you heard him. They've heard Christ through hearing the preachers, of the apostolic preachers, and were taught in him as the truth is in Jesus. May that be so of our children down in the squash court this morning, that they hear Christ speaking to them, that they're taught in him as the truth is in Jesus. There's where the truth is. And they're taught. And grieve over the fact that Sunday schools in the last 40 years in this country have disappeared from vast areas of our country in Bible classes, with all that that must mean. Verse 22, therefore, put off your own nature which belongs to your former manner of life and is corrupt through deceitful lusts. That assumes that our old nature clings very much to us, despite the fact that we're converted, and every morning when we get up we've got to cast it off, and put on the new nature, verse 24, created after the likeness of God into righteousness and holiness. Now the new nature is this new work of God in me, and what am I? What is Christ working in me to do? Verse 24, please. What's he doing? Verse 24. True righteousness. And what is true righteousness and holiness? The likeness of God. And what is the likeness of God? Why is that relevant to me?
Because God's purpose is to create an active.
That's right, to create me in the image of God. That's all the reasoning behind it, isn't it? This is shorthand. He's saying, God is righteousness and holiness. He created man to be in his image, that is, to be righteous and holy. When you were converted, you were recreated in the likeness of God, that is true righteousness and holiness. And that new nature you must put on every day. Now, how do I make the jump between verse 22 and 24? And we're going to finish on this particular note. I think it is so marvelous to get this clear. I hope we're going to finish, almost going to finish, not quite, I mustn't tell lies, it's a very bad habit of preachers to say they're going to finish when they're not. I'm not going to finish just at this point, but very nearly. This is what they call the penultimate point. Now, what's the bridge between 22 and 24? No prizes for this, Doug and Vijay on silence. What is the bridge between verse 22 and verse 24? This is what I would ask them in the squash court. That's right, verse 23. Must be. And what is verse 23 telling me? That I've got to be renewed in the spirit of my mind. Stop on it. He's talking about the spirit of man. He's talking about how we're to be renewed. I am a great believer in renewal, as long as it's the right kind of renewal. And I must honestly say that I've searched for it, but I have never read in modern renewal literature any statement about the renewal of the mind. That's very significant, isn't it? Must be. Let me read. This faculty by which we hold communion with God is conceived to be intimately related to the faculties of thought and reason, to be in some sense a function of the mind. Walking with God calls then for the highest exercise of one's intelligence. It's not an abnegation of the mind. Now, that's terribly unpopular at the moment in some forms of youth Christianity. One of the things that youth Christianity is revolting against is what youth is revolting against, and that is a barren intellectualism, and they're rightly revolting against that. They've said we've had this endless university education, and we still make just the same mistakes in life as we always did. Nobody governs us any better. Our professors don't live any better lives than we do. That's one of the reasons youth have revolted against intellectualism. But we mustn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. In Paul's version of Christianity, you cannot live a Christian life without thinking what you're doing. Which implies that for Paul, Christianity, practical Christianity, is not Sunday school stuff, if I may put it like that. It is difficult because we live in a very complex world. In other words, I often say that we actually are right in the thick of this because business today, and especially following the Big Bang, and medicine and business today are the two areas, par excellence, where ethics are going to be some of the great questions of the next 25 years. Because of the enormous advances in communications in business, the whole communications field, and because of the enormous advances technically in medicine, the ethical questions of those two are going to be in the forefront of the Christian thinking. Now, is it honestly easy to make up your mind about those very technical matters? You know, just to say, love God and do what you like, as St. Augustine said. Well, you know, there's a truth in that, isn't it? If we love God, we shall try to do what he likes. But what does he like? And that's what we're going to meet in chapter 5. And Paul assumes that my mind needs renewing. How did my mind get renewed? By sitting under a teaching ministry, by speaking the truth in love, by coming to a knowledge of the Son of God, by coming to mature manhood, by founding my thinking on the apostles and prophets, by having pastors and teachers who do their work, and so on. In other words, this break with paganism is not just a matter of the heart, it's a matter of the mind as well. It's a tremendous break. And that's why, of course, when we get a renewal of the mind in the churches, and we begin to get true Christian preaching again in the churches, there's going to be an almighty row, of course, from the intellectual establishment. You see, nobody minds the Christian church if it's largely given up to singing choruses and having a good time and so on. But once the Christian church starts touching on these issues plainly and exercising a Christian mind, then there's going to be a tremendous row. And you wait. It hasn't begun yet. What we're trying to do in our preachers' conferences is to say to the young ministers, look, you've got a lifetime's work ahead of you, teaching the Bible and applying it to these things. And if you spend your whole time rushing around making tea for the Mothers' Union, you will never do this job. I mean, John Vorter, thankfully, seems to have seen this long before any of us saw it, and has been working in these principles out in his own church at home, and thank God for that. Now we'll look at one example of this working it out. I want you to take verses 25 to 32 with you into your study period, if you will, and work it out with Paul. You will find that all the examples he gives are examples of how we live together. How very practical Paul is. Living together is the big problem, isn't it? As I said before on the first night, to live above with saints we love, that will be grace and glory. To live below with saints we know is quite another story. And to live together anyhow in the world is the problem, you see. You come to the top of BP and you find that the real problems are not how to get oil out of the North Sea. You've got 100 men in the office who can tell you how to do that. The problem is how to get people to live and relate to one another properly. And so he tells us here, and let me give you the example I love the best, is verse 28. Now, once you've learnt the technique, you can go to the others and apply the same technique. Look at verse 28. Here's, you see what the early church was made of? It was made up of converted people like thieves. Isn't that remarkable? And what was the first thing you tell the converted thief? You say, no, let the thief steal no more. Isn't that clear? Quite wise to remember that, incidentally, I think, in ethical issues today. I think we need to remember it to our Sunday night congregation. It's possible in the student world constantly to discuss things. And students also, like children, need to be told that's a no-no area. Like, for example, homosexual activism. We simply got to say, the Bible says no. Children need to know. Students need to know. There's no debate about it. There are many things that have got to be debated about it, of course, but whether it is right or wrong, the answer is no. Is stealing right or wrong? No, it's not right. So don't. Then next, once you go, what have we got to do? Rather, positive, let him labour, provided there is labour available, of course. This is in a very simple social state, of course, no National Health Service or anything else, or Dole cues or whatnot. He's talking about basic first principles here. So let him labour. And how does he labour? He does honest work. Notice, honest work. And he does it here with his hand. Surely that's a dig at the Greeks, who thought that manual labour was beneath their dignity, so they sat at ease at home instead of earning their living. And the late Victorians were just as guilty of that, weren't they? which is why our educational system finds it so difficult to turn out practical people. And then what will he do when he works with his hands? He will have enough money to live on. No, it doesn't say that.
This talk continues on the next audio file or CD.